I'm William Cooper, and you're listening to The Hour of the Time. Yes, indeed, I'm back in the USA, and I am really glad that I live here, not somewhere else. As you all know, I took a trip to London, England, in the beginning of January, and I spoke at Wembley Arena the 9th and 10th, the Great Hall. And I really didn't know what a big deal this was until I got there and was besieged by the English press. And I literally mean besieged. The press was everywhere. I've done more interviews those few days that I was in London than I've ever done. And finally, I asked one of the BBC interviewers, very nice young woman, answer, what's the big deal? I mean, why is all the press here? I've never had such attention anywhere. In the United States, the press is so tightly controlled that nothing that we ever do is printed. And I was told that if I had not been appearing in the Great Hall at Wembley, that I probably would not have received any attention from the press. It seems that you're nobody until you spoke or performed in the Great Hall at Wembley. I guess in England and in Europe, Wembley is equivalent to Carnegie Hall here in the United States in New York City. So I was a little humbled by this and vowed to do my very best. And I think that I made a big impression over there. Even now, today, I have a message to phone a reporter at the BBC for an interview over the telephone. So even though I've been gone from England for quite some time now, I'm still being interviewed by the English press and by the BBC. I'll tell you, this was a great trip, and it didn't start off so great. Where I live, the weather was really bad, the roads were iced over, and we got up in what we thought was time to drive to the Phoenix airport, and quickly realized that at the speed that we would have to travel over the icy roads, I was not going to make it in time to catch my flight. So, we did a little detour to a small airport in a small town along the way, and found that there was a seat left on the shuttle flight, the small twin-engine plane. I forget what type it was. But after I purchased my ticket and sat down to wait for the flight, which should have already left, actually, if they had left on time, I would not have been able to even be on that flight. But it seems that the military was performing maneuvers in the area, and the plane could not take off until it received clearance. So here we sat. Icy roads outside, cold, overcast, miserable day, waiting for a plane to take off that might not ever take off. Then when we finally got clearance from the military, then it was waiting on the weather. And then when we finally got clearance from the weather, we were all just to the point of almost going home. But we did take off. We had an uneventful flight down to Phoenix. And after a short wait at the Phoenix airport, I caught a flight to Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, I was to switch to another international flight, which would then take me directly nonstop to London. And as I sat waiting for the plane to be for the boarding to be announced, as we all do in airports, you sit, and it's probably the most boring wait that anybody ever goes through. I quickly began to notice that this was not a normal airline. And I quickly began to realize this was not going to be a normal flight. For I got a little restless and walked over to the windows, looked out at this huge, gigantic 747 sitting there at the gate. And immediately, the nose of the aircraft caught my eye, and I felt sort of taken back in time. For there on the nose of this aircraft was painted a beautiful, beautiful woman, scantily dressed in what appeared to be red silk, with a flowing red cape trailing behind her. And under this picture, this portrait, this painting on the nose of this aircraft, were the words, Scarlet Lady. And immediately, I fell in love with that airplane, and I knew that my flight was going to be a very, very good flight. Looking down at my ticket, I then realized that everything about this airline was different. For the name of the airline is Virgin Atlantic. It was a new airline. And the man who owned the airline is the man who used to own Virgin Records, very young man in his 30s. Now, I talked with some of the airline people there, and they told me that the name came from the fact that he had no experience in running an airline, and thus was a virgin. at this game, and so he named it Virgin Atlantic Airlines. Now, he had the same history with his recording studios and his record label when he had purchased or started the record company, actually. He had no experience, but Virgin Records got to be one of the biggest labels in the recording industry. Well, he since sold that company and bought an airline. And that airline is Virgin Atlantic Airlines. I was even more amused and very pleased when I saw the flight crew, the captain and co-pilot and flight engineer, and a host. And when I say host, it was a small crowd, actually, of airline stewards and stewardesses, all dressed in the most beautiful wool uniforms that I have ever seen on any flight crew on any airlines anywhere. And not only were the uniforms beautiful, but they had on these great coats of wool like they used to wear during World War II. It was all very nostalgic, really, and it was like going back in a time warp to some olden time. I would encourage anyone, if you're thinking of flying to Europe, to choose Virgin Atlantic Airlines. Now, my ticket was paid by the people in England who were bringing me over to speak at Wembley. But the price of the ticket is always on the ticket. And I was almost knocked out of my chair because I thought this would be a very expensive flight, no matter what class you flew as. And I looked at my ticket, and down at the lower left-hand corner, it said that my ticket round trip to and from Los Angeles to London, England, Heathrow Airport, was just a little less than $500. I was amazed. Now, I don't know if you can get this rate all the time. I don't know if this was a special rate just for them because of this event at Wembley. I don't know. But I'll tell you that airplane was full wall to wall. Everyone was comfortable. There was plenty of room. The seats seemed to be, and I'm a big man now, and it seemed to me that the seats were a little larger than a normal airline that we might take in the United States, because I was not crowded, and there was a woman sitting next to me who was not a small woman. And we were comfortable the entire trip. Now, this airplane was gorgeous inside. The food was excellent. I mean excellent. Airline food, if you could even say that it was okay, I mean, that's unusual because airline food usually stinks. This food was excellent, actually excellent. The flight attendants were attentive to every need of everyone on that airplane. Now, don't get me wrong, folks. Virgin Atlantic Airlines doesn't even know I exist, much less that I have a radio show, and this is not a paid advertisement. I'm telling you this because I thoroughly enjoyed my flight to England. Thoroughly. Every seat had its own television set. I had never seen this before. Every seat had its own television set, firmly built into the seat in front, with your own controls of how to operate the TV and your own headphones. Everyone was given a kit in a nice little travel bag with a zipper on it, which said Virgin across the side. And inside that travel bag was a toothbrush, were your headphones, nice, really good headphones that, to tell you the truth, I am using right now to make this broadcast. I got this little travel bag going over, and I got one coming back, and we were told that we could keep it. There were many other things in there. There was a comb. There were all kinds of things in this little travel bag, which you normally don't get. And most airlines tell you to leave your headphones on the seat. Many people don't. They take them with them. And then they sterilize them and put new coverings over the earphones and give them out to the next group of passengers. But not on Virgin Atlantic. We had a great time. But I'll tell you, it was a long, long flight, folks. This flight was in excess of 12 hours because we had some headwinds. but we had a great time. When we arrived at Heathrow, I then realized that we were in a foreign country for sure. Most Americans tend to think of England as being very much like America, or America being very much like England, and I can assure you, dear listeners, that that's not true. We may speak the same language, but I guarantee you, we in America are much more fortunate. We have many more freedoms. We have a higher standard of living. And we don't even realize, most of us, how well off we really are. Even faced with the threat of losing these freedoms, and even though we've lost about half of our Bill of Rights so far, in the name of the war on drugs, we still are better off than any other people on the face of this earth. I was met by Keith Mears, who was one of the people who put together the conference at Wembley, the Great Hall, and he took me to the Hilton Hotel, which is right next to Wembley. In fact, every morning I would get up and walk over to Wembley. It wasn't more than a 3 or 4 minute walk from the hotel door, actually, to the arena where I spoke. Now, the conference went on all day, both Saturday and Sunday, the 9th and 10th of January. And so I would get up in the morning and eat my breakfast downstairs in the hotel and walk over to Wembley and spend the day listening to the other speakers and talking with the English people. And I learned some astounding things. And I think you're going to be equally astounded. Things in England and in Europe in general are much more expensive than they are here in the United States. Meals are more expensive. Hotel rooms are more expensive. Taxis are more expensive. Now, you can go out with a family of four in the United States and go to a fast food restaurant, or go to a small restaurant, or an Italian restaurant, or a Chinese food restaurant, and all four people can generally eat for about $25, and everybody be happy, and everybody will be full. In England, I would venture to say, from my experience over that short period of time, going to regular fast food and regular small restaurants, that for four people to eat in England, anywhere at the cheapest place that you can find, will cost you probably $40 or more. It is very expensive. Now, the exchange rate, I noticed, from the time that I left Los Angeles, in fact, in Los Angeles, you could exchange your money for £1, I believe, was $1.46. When we arrived in England, at the airport, £1 was $1.62 or $1.63. At the hotel, the Hilton, £1 was $1.70 some odd cents. I forget exactly, but it was over $1.70. So the exchange rate varies, and what I noticed is you're much better off to exchange your money here in the United States. Thank you. Things that I noticed in England, folks, is that the English act and behave as if the empire is still intact. And of course, we all know that it is not. Everyone I met was very proper, very polite, very, very easy to talk to and to deal with. And even if someone disagreed with what I personally had to say, they were very polite in their disagreement, which the English are typically famous for. Their reserved manner, their dry humor, and their impeccable manners, I found to be very, very pleasing. I really liked everyone that I met in England, from the people who crewed the airplane, which Virgin Atlantic is a British airlines, to the people I met at the airport. Keith Mears, Mary Seal were just wonderful and attended to my every need. All of the people in the hotel staff, the dining room staff, everybody at the Great Hall at Wembley, the people backstage who attended to our audiovisual needs and the raising or dimming of the lights when we needed that to be done, were just exceptional, polite, wonderful, wonderful people. And I thank them all, every single one of them. And especially the audiovisual man who put up with quite a bit from all of us and changing schedules at the last minute and changing which tape was going to be shown or which tray of slides was going to be put on next, and he never lost his temper. He maintained his politeness and his manners the whole time. John, thank you from the bottom of my heart for what you did for me backstage both days. You worked long, hard hours, and tell you the truth, I never saw him take a break either day from from about 8 in the morning when I would arrive until well after 9 p.m., John was right there doing his thing. I didn't see him eat, although I know he did somehow. He probably ate while we were on stage talking. But we were treated wonderfully, as if we were kings and queens ourselves. So that much about the British people is true. They are polite. They are wonderful people. Their display of just ordinary common sense is so much better than most Americans ever display, that I fail to see how they got into the position that they're in today. And their country is already socialist. It is so socialist that I don't think they can extract themselves from that position. Because once people begin receiving handouts, it's hard to take them away from them. Even if the people know that it's not good for them, they still don't want to give up those handouts. And that's the position that we Americans are quickly finding ourselves in. Right now, we have an elderly group that literally are begging for more. They just love it so much. It's a shame. We should learn to depend upon ourselves for our support, our subsistence. And of course, in extreme hardship, in case of people are disabled and cannot insure, we should provide some type of charity to meet their needs, not make them rich. And the rest of us, if we fail through our own ignorance, stupidity, or irresponsibility to provide for our old age, I'm telling you right now, I'm one who believes you should be subject to the laws of nature, and that's exactly the way it should be. You see, we demonstrate such a degree of irresponsibility that it's absolutely incredible. Do you know that in England, the unemployment stipend for someone who is unemployed is only $60 a week. And you cannot even rent a place to stay for $60 a week, much less feed yourself. Did you know that? Did you know that the English people are suffering, that Europe is in a real depression? And remember, I told you this a long time ago. But Americans don't want to listen. You listen to your government tell you that we're in the midst of a recovery. And folks, I'm telling you right now, no such thing is taking place. The world cannot be in a depression and the United States be in a recovery. It can't happen. Our businesses are leaving, deserting our country in record numbers. Everywhere, people are being laid off. Everywhere, companies are going out of business. And yet you still believe this nonsense that we're in a recovery. Oh, sheeple. Oh, sheeple. Shame on you. The people in England, and by the way, they just weren't people from England. They had many people in Europe listen to my broadcast. And there were people from Scotland, from Ireland, from France, from Germany, from Switzerland, from all over Europe. And I learned quite a lot while I was there. Europe is in the throes of a depression. Did you know that Euro Disney is having such a hard time attracting visitors to their Disney park that they're actually advertising in the United States for American tourists to visit Euro Disney when they visit Europe? Now that should tell you how hard off things are in Europe. Because it's absolutely insane to ask Americans to go to Europe to visit Disneyland when we have two Disneylands right here and most Americans have already been. No, folks, when we go to Europe, we want to see Europe. We don't want to see Disneyland. But you see, the Europeans are in such financial straits that they're not going to Euro Disney. And Euro Disney is finding itself in deep financial problems, and that's why they're advertising for tours from the United States to visit Euro Disney. Not only that, but Euro Disney is built in a spot, I learned, that has traditionally bad weather. Bad weather. So when most folks go, it's either raining or overcast or cold. Very smart. Whoever did that, all I can say is very smart. Also, I learned that the position of the secret societies in Europe is not a secret in Europe as it is here in the United States. They're well aware that they're under the thumb of Freemasonry, and they openly complain that the legal system in England is controlled completely by Freemason judges and barristers. And they have no misconceptions about what it means for their future. So, the conference on the first day was very good. And turn off that echo there. Was very good, and everyone made quite a hit, except for one person. And I'm not going to mention who this person's name is, because I don't want to give him any press, to tell you the truth, after what he did. But it seems that he was caught talking on a portable telephone to the Russian embassy and then proceeded to discredit himself, and by so doing, hoped to discredit the entire conference. Well, that didn't happen. But he used as his sources nothing but tabloids, ridiculous stories, totally made a laughing stock out of himself and his presentation. And he'd never done this before. So I knew that this, of course, was intentional. The conference organizers knew that this was intentional. And he did not succeed in discrediting the conference. However, the tabloids in England had a field day totally discrediting this one individual. And I'll leave it up to you to figure out who that was. But made a laughing stock out of himself. And, of course, will never be invited back to England. I was impressed with all the people there who were so kind to me and who brought me I'll tell you something. I came back with more pamphlets and books and literature and information that was handed to me by strangers, and some of them to this day, I don't know who they are. Some of them, we had talks, and I got to know them a little bit. But and you're going to be hearing a lot of this stuff that I brought back with me on future shows of the Hour of the Time. The people in England are undergoing some tough times, folks. The police, the bobbies, the famous bobbies, are not going to be under local control anymore. They are all being gathered into what's going to be a British National Police under the direct orders of Whitehall. The same thing is going to happen in this country, and there's already a big push on to make it happen. And that's one of my predictions in the Carter administration, is that you're going to see the beginnings of the formation of a national police force. And, of course, the excuse will be for young people to serve their country. And he's already stated that he wants to swell the ranks of the police by over 100,000 new members. Well, unless he makes it a national police force, he can't do that, simply because the local police in every city and town in this country do not come under federal control. But you watch it happen. That's one of my predictions, and so far I've only been wrong on one prediction I've ever made, and that was the prediction that Manuel Noriega would not be convicted in an American court or serve any time in an American prison. I was wrong. Seems that he must have made some deal in order to keep his mouth shut. He's going to take it, and when the New World Order is finally put together, they'll probably give him his reward and send him off to live in some mansion somewhere in the Caribbean. But that's neither here nor there. I predict, we already know, that it's public knowledge in England, that the English police are going to be formed into a national police directly under Whitehall. And I'm telling you, the same thing is going to happen here in the United States. I get a lot of stuff. Some Canadian people flew over to attend this conference and gave me a lot of things in Canada. And I've been getting a lot of mail from Canada. And a lot of support for this radio show has come from Canada, too. You see, they're already in the New World Order. They've already lost their constitution. It's open up in Canada what's coming, and those people are angry. They feel helpless. They don't know what to do. But don't be helpless, folks. No government ever existed in the history of the world without the consent of the governed. And all that needs to happen for evil to win out is for a few good men to do nothing. Just remember that. Also, in England, I found out that they're having the same overflights of black helicopters that we're having here. And it appears that in most of the countries where people have traditionally enjoyed freedom, they know those people might have a tendency to take up arms when they find out that they're losing all of their freedom. So these, what they call urban guerrilla warfare teams, are practicing rounding up patriots. Is exactly what it is. And you're going to find more and more of it happening. It's already happened in most of the major cities in this country. Overflights of black helicopters, landings, troops, National Guard, military people taking over small towns and cities and going door to door in some towns. Right, yes, folks, right here in the United States. I'm not talking about overseas. I'm talking about right here. It's already happening. You're seeing the manipulation of the young people and a resurgence of fascism, National Socialism in Germany. And the New World Order is going to be totalitarian and socialist in nature. Remember, Hitler was a socialist. Nazi Germany was National Socialism. Don't let anybody fool you. All these things about the right and the left and the right's going to take over and the Nazis will rule is a bunch of crap, folks. The people on the right want less government. The people on the left want total government. Total government. Nazism or National Socialism is just one small step above communism. That's where everything is headed. Everything is moving toward global socialism. World socialism. That's what's coming. Don't be fooled. Don't let these jerks fool you by the use of the word democracy or democratic. Those are just keywords for socialism. The United States was never founded, nor was it ever meant to be a democracy. It is a republic, and there's a big difference between those two. Democracy always leads into full-blown socialism. Republic, if the people are responsible, gives the most freedom for each individual that can ever be realized in the world. Problem is, when people get what they think is the I got everything that I need, so I don't have to worry about it anymore, they don't care anymore, they quit watching, they quit participating, they abdicate, and everything goes to hell in a handbag real quick. I found, as you will find if you take a trip to Europe also, the Europeans do not live in any kind of any life approaching the affluence that the average American lives with every day of his life. There's a lot of talk about poverty in this country, folks. I'm telling you right now, unless you've traveled overseas and have really seen poverty, you do not know the meaning of the word. No one in this country is living in poverty. No one in this country is really poor in the real sense of the word, as you will find poor people in other countries of this world. Even the Americans that are the least well off in this country are so far ahead of the poor people in other countries that it is absolutely amazing. And they have an opportunity to take themselves out of that poverty in this country, as they do not have in other countries. If Americans choose to remain at a level of poverty, uneducated, unable to work because they have no skills, I'm going to tell you right now, folks, you can disagree, you can jump up and down, you can holler, you can call me whatever names you want to, it's absolutely true. It is of their own choosing, because everyone in this country has whatever opportunity they wish to take, and they can make of their lives whatever they wish to make of their lives. The problem with most Americans who find themselves in those conditions, however, just don't believe they can do it, so they don't even try. But this whole country is nothing but stories of people who've come out of poverty and made great empires in business, in the arts, in everything that you can think of, because they just did it. And you can do that too. There is, around the world, a great restlessness. Everyone knows that things are changing. Everyone knows that nothing is going to be the same. Everyone is afraid, because the unknown is what upsets human beings more than anything. And everybody is looking for answers, and no one is getting any answers. And that was one of the things that people expressed in England, most of all, is what's happening? What's going on? What is going to come of all of this? Well, what's going to come of it, folks, is what we make of it. Change is coming. There's no way that anyone is going to stop change. But we can direct the path of that change, and we can make it into something good, or we can let it become something bad, or anywhere in between. But it's going to be our doing. You see, the only way that it can turn out to be terribly bad and repressive, the only way that they can put us into chains, make us slaves. By chains, I mean figuratively, not literally. However, it could be literally for many of us, people like me, who are openly resisting and who are stirring you to action. We can make the world whatever we wish it to be through our actions, our abdications. If you want the future to be terrible, if you want to go backwards into slavery, then I suggest, dear listeners, you do nothing. Now, please, don't give me this bit about I'm just one lonely, helpless little human being and there's nothing that I can do. because it's just not true. It's just not true. If you look back to the history of this nation, and even the history of the world, you'll find that everything that's ever been accomplished in this world has been accomplished by one lonely, helpless, scared human being who dared to do what others said could not be done. Who dared to do what others said could not be done. People have told me I can't do what I'm doing. They told me I couldn't write a book. They told me if I did, I'd be killed. They told me I could never get my own radio show and I'd never be able to broadcast to anybody. And if I did, I'd be killed. They told me that no one would listen. They told me that I would be attacked and that my credibility and my life would be destroyed. And I said, I can and I will. And I did. And I was attacked viciously, and I'm still attacked, and will always be attacked as long as I do what I do, because anyone throughout the history of the world who dared to speak the truth was always attacked. That's what this tendency toward political correctness is. Politically correct thinking is Nazi thinking. It's the control of your thoughts. It's thinking and professing something that you know is not true simply because it is politically desirable rather than truthful. You see? The suppression of Galileo by the Catholic Church was politically correct, but it was a lie. It was untrue because Galileo was right. Galileo was speaking the truth, but he had to suffer and be imprisoned for the rest of his life. Simply because he dared to speak the truth, because it was not politically correct. Anyone who propounds and advocates the policy of politically correctness, political correctness in your speech and writing is a fool, is already a slave in their mind, and are attempting to force that slavery onto the rest of us. Political correctness is a lie. Carter has appointed someone to his cabinet who is a propounder of political correctness. Her name is Donna Shalala. She was the head of a large university in her home state. And let me tell you what she did, folks. She advocated, demanded, and enforced political correctness. And she forbade any professor, any head of any department, any administrator, or any student to ever utter the words, Founding Fathers. Founding Fathers. And this person has been appointed to occupy a cabinet position in the government of the United States of America. Donna Shalala has to go. Donna Shalala has to go. Bill Clinton has to go. You see, because they're all socialists. And you're going to see them destroy this country even more than it's been destroyed, inch by inch. Inch by inch. You are already watching it happen. You can already see it in the first week of his presidency. You saw it beginning to take place. This is going to be the most disappointing, most aggravating, most anger-inciting presidency in the history of this country. You mark my words. That's another prediction that I am making. And they knew that in Europe. Oh, I heard that from many people in Europe. I already knew it. You see, Bill Clinton didn't win by the popular vote. He won by the electoral vote. Presidents aren't elected by popular vote in this country. Popular vote means nothing. And Bill Clinton's presidency was ensured when it was decided that he would be the next president at the Bilderberg Group meeting in 1991 in Baden-Baden, Germany. And I stated, when I knew that they had determined that he would be the next president, I stated in all my lectures from that point on, that Bill Clinton would be the next president, unequivocally, with no reservations whatsoever, that it was a certainty. And you saw that it was a certainty. The Bilderberg Group is so powerful, folks, that George Bush didn't even dare to really conduct a campaign against Bill Clinton and didn't even decide to even try or even make the American people think that he was conducting a campaign until it was way too late for him to win the electoral vote. One of the things that disturbed me deeply while I was in England was the apparent glee and willingness of the English people to be subjects. Where in the United States of America, it has traditionally been our pride to be kings. To be kings. And it is in our law. So, folks, I hope you learned something tonight. For those of you out there listening, good night, and God bless you. And to those of you in England, I'll be back.